From WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Kelly Knoyer. Gen X. It's been in the water for decades, but we only found out 8 years ago. I know when I moved here 4 years ago, it took some time to really understand the lay of the land, and it just kept shifting. There's so much to keep track of. Lawsuits, political disputes, filtration systems, and the Great Wall of Fayetteville. Not to mention federal policy on PFAS, or lack thereof. We thought we'd take today's episode to really set the table for anyone new in town. If you've been confused about PFAS, we're about to share with you the real story, the emotional story, and the facts. So let's start with where it all started, with a groundbreaking story in the Star News. With me now is Vaughn Haggerty, currently a spokesperson for CFPUA, but you're also the original person who broke the news about Gen X in the Cape Fear region, and I really just want to hear about how you found this story.
Hi, Kelly. Thanks for having me. So in probably spring 2017, I had decided to do some freelance reporting. I reached out to the Star News, who used to be my employer. So the second news story that I started working on involved some data that was available from what is EPA's Unregulated Contaminant Monitoring Rule, or UCMR. So I wanted to know, well, has anybody else already done this story? And so I Googled, and on the first page of results was a presentation that had been done by a professor at NC State University named Detlef Kanapi. I looked at the presentation, and it talked about a number of emerging contaminants that he was looking at, and one of them was this thing called Gen X that apparently had been found in the Cape Fear River and also in the treated drinking water supply of an unnamed utility. So I thought, oh, that's interesting. And I Googled around and found the paper that this was based on, and at that point, I was no longer reporting on PFOA. I was reporting on Gen X.
So when you initially broke this story, do you feel like you also knew, or that Detlef knew, that it was potentially dangerous for humans?
Well, interestingly, DuPont at the time, when they applied to the EPA to do this, that included a number of studies. And so what these researchers told me is that while Gen X might not stay in the body as long as PFOA, some of the potential health results from exposure to it seem to be similar to those for PFOA. And interestingly, the EPA sort of said the same thing, and then they signed off on going ahead and making it, right? But they said you have to capture all but 99% from going into the environment.
And was that happening, or were they letting,
Here's the thing. So there's the Gen X that they make, and that's made in a separate facility, and supposedly all the wastewater from that is captured and sent off-site to some poor community in Texas for deep well injection. However, what it turned out was that there was a different process. It's been going on at the Fayetteville Works since 1980. That was creating Gen X as a byproduct. And that was the Gen X that was found in the river. Now, the other interesting thing is that this pre-manufacturing notice had a little appendix. And that little appendix said, well, you know, all these things that you have to do, regulatory things you have to do regarding this chemical, don't apply to byproducts that are created as a result that you aren't selling.
Wow. So they could just release all of that Gen X they were creating directly into the river.
Oh, yeah.
Even though in a different situation, they were required to capture so much of it, they could just let it all go into the river.
Kelly, they knew. They knew. So before I was going to publish a story, I contacted Chemours, and they told me they had put in some sort of filter device in, I want to say it was 2013, in order to filter out or reduce the amount of Gen X and other PFAS going in the water. But not only that, maybe two to three years ago, Chemours sued DuPont because they were saying, hey, maybe you guys underestimated the liabilities here, right? And in their lawsuit, their filing, they detailed how there was some kind of a blue ribbon committee that was put together, and they came up with all these different things that DuPont at the time could do to reduce the amount of PFAS, and it ranged from something costing $80 million down to something far cheaper, maybe a few million. Well, guess which one they chose?
The few million.
Could
I have you kind of paint the picture of how it felt right before this story published. I know that when I've launched big investigations, there's a little bit of that feeling in your heart, like, ooh, how are people going to feel about this? How did you feel that night before it launched?
Well, it wasn't just a night, right? We were going to publish the next day, and I was just struggling to write the story correctly. The first draft was just terrible. And so I spent literally that whole weekend, I put on my editor hat, right, and rewrote the entire thing. And it, I was really pleased, I think, with the way it turned out. I felt like it was well organized, certainly did not bury the lead. And I would say that that was me. That was me on my own.
Yeah, you were your own editor there.
I was my own editor. And I would say that I also had a huge advantage over your typical journalist who works at a, you know, any organization. I had plenty of time. I mean, remember, I started this story maybe 6 weeks before that. So, I mean, how many people now, especially at local news organizations, have that luxury of time to work on one single story?
Nobody has that
Nobody
anymore.
Nobody does, right?
Yeah. Do you remember what your lead was?
Okay. Now, I admit I'm reading this, but a chemical replacement for a key ingredient in Teflon linked to cancer and a host of other ailments has been found in the drinking water system of the Cape Fear Public Utility Authority, which cannot filter it.
Oof. Yeah. You read that in your newspaper in the morning and you go, oh my God, what does this mean for me?
Right. Well, I would then after that go out and to coffee shops, whatever, and I see people actually reading the paper version of the newspaper, which, I mean, really was kind of an oddity at the time, right?
So it drew some attention.
I think it drew some attention.
It really, really did. In addition to speaking with Vaughn, we interviewed a few advocates about what it was like in those first few months and years. I asked Cape Fear Riverkeeper Kemp Burdett to recall that time.
By the time folks in town started sitting down and talking about things, you know, we were in that still information gathering while also fielding dozens of phone calls from terrified people who were like, I've been making bottles with this for my kid for a year. What does that mean? You know, like, how do I make sure my water's safe?
That uncertainty was pervasive. Dana Sargent worked with Burdett at the time at the Cape Fear River Watch, and the organization became instrumental in protecting Cape Fear residents from pollution, thanks to a consent decree they intervened on between the polluter Chemours and the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality.
Nothing would have happened without the consent order, right? So we know this because we're 8 years in and there's not one law passed in the North Carolina General Assembly protecting people from PFAS. There's not one law that's standing in the federal government protecting people against PFAS.
Cape Fear River Watch existed before the PFAS crisis came to light. But others became immediately involved, out of anger or fear or the drive to just do something to protect themselves and their neighbors' health. Emily Donovan with Clean Cape Fear says that when Chemours came to town,
protests erupted all over the city, but it wasn't organized. You had one big protest down by the river that had the most people show up. Then you had a smaller protest at the actual location of the Chemours meeting. And there was also like this Facebook group. Everybody started coming to this one Facebook group, Stop Gen X in Our Water. And so people were mobilizing in there and we were talking through that. So and then you're right, like Harper, Kemp, and Jessica, everyone was looking around going, we're not going to be able to do this fractured.
That led to the creation of Clean Cape Fear. They focused on education and advocacy. Advocates started reaching out to other communities impacted by PFAS, trying to learn everything they could. But it all happened very, very fast. Things have slowed down, though, says Jessica Cannon from Clean Cape Fear. Lobbyists have done everything they can to stop legislation that would protect the river or get recompense for its effects.
I think it has just been profoundly disappointing that the local chamber hasn't taken a more aggressive, muscular stance. They have absolutely 100% refused to stand up and to fight for clean water here in town, here in our area. And I don't understand it.
Coming up after this break, we'll hear more about just what those first few weeks felt like and how the fight goes on. It'll come from a terrific panel of reporters who were all there at the time. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. You're listening to The Newsroom. I'm Kelly Kanoyer. Thank you for joining us. Today is all about PFAS and the Gen X crisis that has impacted Wilmington for decades. Let's jump into this panel with guests Ben Shockman, Lisa Sorg, and Adam Wagner. All right, I'm here with a brain trust of reporters who were on the scene at the time when we found out that there was a tremendous amount of PFAS in the Cape Fear River. I'd love to have us kind of go around and introduce ourselves. I'm going to start with my boss for obvious reasons. Ben, where were you in 2017 and where are you now?
Shameless. I think I had just become the assistant editor at Port City Daily in the summer of 2017. And now I'm the news director here at WHQR.
I'm Lisa Sorg, and I was a reporter, the environmental reporter at NC Policy Watch at the time, which was based in Raleigh, and I covered the entire state. And now I'm the North Carolina reporter for Inside Climate News.
My name is Adam Wagner. I was a regional environmental reporter at the Wilmington Star News, and now I am a reporter and editor at the North Carolina Newsroom.
I want to start us in media res. There was a press conference about a week after this news broke in the Star where ChemWars had executives come down to Wilmington and they met with some of the leadership here in the Cape Fear region. And there was kind of a private meeting that Adam was the pool reporter for. So I want to hear what that was like for the reporters who weren't invited into that room. And then I want to hear what it was like to be the reporter in that room.
I'll say, and Adam can confirm this, that we were probably a little snarky at the time because we felt like this huge story had dropped and we had just been elbowed out. And Star broke it. It was theirs. We were all chasing. That's all fair. But we were all being held at arm's length from this really important meeting. But on the other hand, we were glad that, I mean, I'm not blowing smoke here. Like, we were glad it was you in the room because we trusted your reporting. I think if it had been someone, you know, that we didn't know the reporting as well, we'd be like, oh, man, they're going to get this wrong.
And in that room, what was it like?
It was stressful because you had to type really fast. I mean, realistically, you had an international company talking with the most important lawmakers and leaders of the state. And this was our first shot at all of them. And I think we kind of knew at that time that this might be our last chance to hear from Chemours for a while. I mean, I was surprised that there was a reporter in the room at all, frankly. And it was great that there was. The biggest thing that I think came out of that was the admission from Chemours that they had been doing this process that was leading to Gen X in the river since 1980. And that was sort of a jaw-drop moment for, I think, everybody in the room. I mean, I think even Cooper and Regan were like, how long? That's just decades and decades and decades of exposure that we didn't know the impact of. And we still don't know the impact of.
So that's then Governor Roy Cooper and then DEQ Secretary Michael Regan, who then went to lead the EPA. Who were some of the other faces in that room at the time?
You had New Hanover County Commissioners. Woody White was there. You had Chris Coudray. Bill Saffo was there. There were Brunswick County leaders.
And were they angry? How were they talking to these executives?
I don't recall anger. It was more just, we need to know what's going on here because there were so many unknowns at the time. I mean, the biggest reaction, I think, was uncertainty. And I think it went that way for months. Like, really, what is this chemical? What else is in there? How is this getting here? How did this happen? And just like trying to get the answers to those very simple questions was really difficult for, again, like months and months and months.
So the legend has become that Woody White, you know, sort of served Cape Fear tap water to everyone in the room. You know, and this is a week after we learned that there was, you know, this unfilterable toxin in it and sort of, you know, served glasses to the ChemWars folks and they kind of didn't touch it. So I'm curious, like, did that actually happen? How did that actually happen?
It did happen. I don't remember if they drank them over the course of the meeting. I was really sort of locked in on getting what is everything being said. But there was CFPUA drinking water on the table, and it was poured into glasses.
That's good enough. I love it.
Can we talk a little bit about what ChemWars is? Because it's a company that a lot of people don't really understand its origin story, and it's kind of weird. So, Lisa, if you'd like to jump in on that.
Well, it's a spinoff of DuPont, and it's, you know, it's 100 miles upstream. That's the thing that some people don't realize. This is not a Wilmington company. This is what you would think would be far away. So they're on the Cumberland-Bladen County line. I think they're technically actually in Bladen County. And they make polymers and resins and surfactants and all sorts of things that are supposed to make our lives better. So one of the things that happens during that process, though, is that Gen X is created. And as Adam said, 35 years, yes, had been putting that into the Cape Fear River through their discharge. So I remember I heard Detlef Canapi say once, if it's convenient, it probably has PFAS in it. Cortex, Teflon, your stain-free couch.
I mean, I was driving down here, and there was a spot of rain, and I was watching the raindrops glide up my windshield, and I was thinking, oh, that's PFAS. That's why those raindrops are gliding up my windshield instead of just sticking.
Yeah, a story we did maybe like a month after. And again, everyone was chasing the Star News, and we didn't know what you guys knew. I don't think the media ecosystem was as collaborative as it is now. But everyone was just looking for another angle, another piece of the puzzle. And like Adam said, beyond ChemWars, like, it was hard to get info out of DEQ. It was damn near impossible to get anything out of the Trump EPA at that point. And one of the first actual pieces of information we got out of the EPA was a risk assessment of where they thought people were getting exposed to Gen X and then PFAS more broadly. And they basically didn't know, but they set basically like a floor of 20%, where they said, like, it's probably less than 20%, but about, let's say, at most 20% of your exposure to Gen X is coming from water, is coming from drinking water. And we thought, well, are we missing 4/5 of the story? Are we missing 80%? Like, where could it possibly come from? And that was the beginning of us all learning about forever chemicals and being like, oh, yeah, it's in the fast food wrapping. It's in the Gore-Tex. It's, you know, it's in my super convenient nonstick
egg pan. It's dust in your house.
It's dust in your house. It's everywhere. I
have enough. The leachate off the dump.
I have enough PFAS in my body to make a new nonstick pan. You know, like, we were, but all of that was new to us, you know, and trying to decipher, you know, the arcane, you know, EPA and DEQ documents about it, were like, this can't be right. But it kind of was.
Now, let's jump back to the what is ChemWars question for a second, because ChemWars spun out of DuPont's legal issues from other kind of forever chemicals.
Yes, they were up against a lawsuit, and they also voluntarily phased those out because they knew they were going to get slammed.
And then they started making Gen X in Fayetteville Works. And ChemWars has always been very careful to say, we are not DuPont. To the degree that it might have been the next summer, they had some reporters visit their plant. And there was literally a sign, like, when you walked in, that said something to the effect of, we are the youngest 100-year-old company in the world, or something. It was something like that. And it was very much like this not-so-subtle nod to their history, but also trying to say, we're not that.
Right. There's also this tremendous irony that ChemWars was cobbled together from all of the literally and legally toxic assets of DuPont. Like, anything that was getting them sued or could get them sued, they took it all together and they made a company out of it. And the conventional wisdom in reporting from, like, Forbes and Wall Street Journal, you know, people who follow this stuff much more closely than a regional local reporter, was like, yeah, this thing is, they're going to stand it up, it's going to get buried in litigation, it's going to go bankrupt, and all of the liability is going to disappear into bankruptcy court. But then it thrived. ChemWars thrived. It started making, like, tons of money, which was, like, for us here in Southeastern North Carolina, just an added twist of the knife.
Well, and we might remember that Josh Stein, as attorney general, sued ChemWars, saying, you know, you actually do have assets. They're just locked up in DuPont, and they're indistinguishable. And how his argument was, this is a shell game. We should be able to sue and get damages because ChemWars is really just DuPont.
Yes, I don't know about you, but in writing about that lawsuit, I had to, like, diagram out, like, what went where. Because even just reading the lawsuit was really hard to follow. And it literally, like, little boxes on a page, and then just, like, having to look at it and try to make sense of what assets were in what company now and which is which. And there's, like, three different things that have the name DuPont now somehow. It's really difficult to follow.
It's like those crazy boards where you have, yes, the thread. Like, in Homeland, the agent has got all
the
connections.
It's always sunny in Philadelphia for me.
Yes.
It's one more thing I want to add, too, is that, you know, most people who are coming to the story now and have been following it for the last couple of years, ChemWars is a pretty recognizable bad guy. And I think it's fair to say that they have been a bad actor in some ways. But that wasn't explicitly immediately clear when Star dropped their news article, at least, like, taking the temperature of the people who showed up to that press conference. There were people who were mad at CFPUA. There were people who were mad at the county. There were people who were mad at the city. There were people who were mad at ChemWars. There were people mad at Adam. I'm kidding. But it was not clear, like, who had been responsible for this, who had dropped the ball. There was a lot of rumors flying around. And it did take a while for this to coalesce into sort of this David and Goliath story of, like, us versus the big, bad chemical company.
The unknowns were so unknown that one of the big debates we had internally was, is it responsible to put the word toxic in the headline? Because the headline was toxic chemical taints CFPUA tap water. And there were a lot of people in the newsroom. I think I was in this camp at the time. We were like, can we say toxic? Do we know that? Is that responsible? Because that's going to trigger a reaction that's going to have, as we've seen going on, 8 years of domino effects.
On the one hand, it's incredibly difficult to come to a conclusion like carcinogenic about a single chemical, let alone a family of thousands of chemicals like the PFAS family. On the other hand, it's unlikely that chemicals like this are great for you. And there are other governments, other cultural approaches where the precautionary principle is the guiding principle where they say, yeah, maybe this is good for you, maybe it's not, probably not. Let's go ahead and prove or get some pretty solid evidence behind the fact that this is safe to dump in large quantities in the water before we let you do it, as opposed to the American regulatory approach, which is to hand responsibility off to the courts and say, well, until someone either in a laboratory or courtroom proves that this is harmful, let her rip. You know, so at the time we were having those debates, but I think that's still kind of where we are, where, you know, we watched the Biden EPA roll out what some people would consider to be nonsensical levels for drinking water safety that were smaller quantities than you can even test for. That is on the face of it nonsensical. But they were trying to respond to the emotional demand to regulate these chemicals. But that put a lot of pressure on utilities. But we shouldn't even be having this debate, because why is the onus on the reporters and the ratepayers and the utilities to deal with this mess? Why is it not on Chemours to make sure that all of these questions were answered before they put, you know, gallons of this stuff in our water?
After this news broke, after this summer of chaos that we talked about, as you've said, there was kind of this need to figure out all these different threads. And I kind of want to know how you prioritize these things with your limited resources. Let's start with how bad is this chemical anyways? Is it toxic? What did it take to figure out that it probably is?
It is toxic. It took scientists doing that work, actually like doing panels on it and evaluating it in rats and mice.
It took quite a while for them to come to a conclusion on certain health effects. And in the meantime, remember, Department of Health and Human Services had a really high advisory goal, far higher than it, you know, is now, because they just didn't know. And I remember just there being so many discussions about how bad is it. And I also remember there was a meeting in New Hanover County where Larry Cahoon said this. He was so prescient in knowing this. He says, this is not the only thing in the drinking water. It is a cocktail. And he was right.
Yeah, I mean, now you look at CFPUA's website and you can track, there's a couple dozen, like, different PFAS chemicals. And I remember, like, at the time, each new chemical we learned about was, like, a new breaking news story. But, like, it was slowly dawning on us that, like, yeah, there's an enormous amount of these, you know, fluorinated chemicals in the water.
But that's the other part of the is it toxic question. It's, are all of these other things toxic, too? And, like, do we even know, and how do they work together? And, like, or do we even have a full picture yet? And I'm not sure that we do.
Right, and I think the biggest, like, pull the camera out the most is, you know, is what's coming through the water interacting with what we're getting through our clothing, through our nonstick paneling, in the air. Like, I still think that I can't imagine a world in which it's good, but we just don't know, you know, what the full, you know, health picture is. Also, just a quick note, when you're talking about health levels, we were talking about parts per trillion and nanoliters. And we all struggle. I personally failed repeatedly to come up with good metaphors. I think my first metaphor was a nanoliter was equivalent to 1 gallon of water compared to 1.5 million Olympic swimming pools, which is only a helpful mental image if you can imagine 1.5 million Olympic swimming pools.
I want to ask about the filtration, too. CFPUA, H2GO, there was a lot going on with the utilities down here at the time. When did they start figuring out what they were going to do? I know there were questions about how you even do filter this stuff out.
I mean, this is a whole, we could do a whole other podcast on this, but I will say there had been all of this political and to some extent partisan fight over a reverse osmosis plant for H2GO, which hadn't garnered a lot of support. It was a very expensive program for a pretty small sanitary district, which is like a freestanding utility. And one of many reasons they had thrown out was that we might find some toxin in the water down the line.
They knew about 1,4-dioxane.
And they knew about 1,4-dioxane. But it was also about sort of their competition with Leland and Brunswick County for ratepayers. And so the banging drum for the reverse osmosis plant wasn't some unknown toxin on the horizon, although it was part of the conversation. But they then started to look like they had been very, very prescient. Like they've been very, very right about this. And that was just one knock-on story. I mean, then you had Brunswick County's approach, which we, as we're recording this, they still haven't delivered on that, which I think there's some credible evidence that leaders in Brunswick County just overpromised because of the extreme pressure to get it done soon because it was scaring people. And then CFPUA's approach, which was, you know, different technology. And even there was some shenanigans around how they were representing the cost. And they did a survey of ratepayers, and they were kind of, you know, they weren't lying, but they were saying, you know, like 50% of people would be willing to pay up to $20, which is true. But of that 50%, many were like, hey, maybe a dollar, you know. So there was, once the cost came into view, I guess the us versus them narrative fell apart a little bit is what I can say about all that.
Yeah. I will say on filtration, as a reporter who moved here from a state renowned for its clean water back on the West Coast in Oregon, I showed up here. I don't think you told me too much about PFAS until I'd already moved, which was probably wise. And then I show up and you're like, yeah, by the way, there's poison in the water. Do you want to cover it? I remember for the first several years that I was working here, when I was learning about PFAS, interviewing Jamie and all these other scientists about what was going on, I started bringing gallons to work because we have an under-sink filter that filters out PFAS here at WHQR. And I would fill up gallons of water and carry them home on my bike every day. Every single day I would do that.
There was some disaster capitalism. I'll just say that.
Well, and I think the other thing to remember is that the filtration system that the utility put on there, like those membranes and the filters, they're shipped to facilities that then burn them. I think Vaughn might have even told me once they go to either Buffalo or Columbus, Ohio. Calgon, I believe, is in Columbus.
Calgon, take the Gen X away.
Yeah. Indeed. And I looked up that plant, and it is, of course, in a black neighborhood.
Mm.
So this is the issue, is that they are forever chemicals, at least for now, until we can figure out how to really break the carbon-fluorine bond. But somebody's downstream is still going to pay.
I remember just, like, at a certain point, this became, like, this absurd global network of environmental issues. When they were shipping it out to Texas and, like, shooting it into a super deep hole in the earth.
In a fracking well. Literally in a fracking well.
Which seemed like the beginning of a 60s sci-fi movie.
I think they're still doing that, too.
It's Deer Park, Texas.
Deer Park, yes.
Yes, and some of it was also going to a hazardous waste landfill in Emil, Alabama, where I went earlier this year just to see it. It's enormous. Now, this is a special kind of landfill, but again, this is in a black neighborhood. And so I want to emphasize that while, you know, we're grateful that some of us have cleaner drinking water, there are people who are paying for this way down the line.
That was Lisa Sorg, a reporter from NC Policy Watch, speaking on a panel of reporters about the impact of PFAS in the Cape Fear region. Up next, we'll hear about the consent decree that has defined the path forward since 2019. Stay with us. Welcome back to the newsroom. I'm Kelly Knoyer. Thank you for joining us. Today, we're digging into the legacy of PFAS in the Cape Fear region with a panel of reporters who've been here since the beginning. Lisa Sorg, Adam Wagner, and WHQR's own Ben Shockman. Let's get back into it. I do want to talk about lawsuits. I think that's what I'd like to discuss next. There's obviously CFPUA's lawsuit still ongoing against Chemours, but I think let's start with the lawsuit that led to the 2019 consent decree, which has really determined the shape of this entire situation in the Cape Fear region since then.
I think it's a controversial document because certain classes of drinking water users were covered in that agreement and certain ones were not. when you think about folks that were left out of that agreement, that has caused some friction. And
are you talking about folks who were closer to the facility versus those downstream?
Yes. Yeah.
So that's well water users. It's also smaller utilities downstream. So I know HQR has done some reporting on like Aqua's customers in New Hanover County who do not have the protections afforded CFPUA customers.
Yeah, I think that gets left out of the conversation a lot. It's just easier when you're looking at a region to talk about, you know, the big county or, you know, regional water services. But, yeah, there's all this unincorporated county land where private businesses have inherited this problem.
Talking to Dana Sargent, who was with Cape Fear River Watch at the time, she called it a triage effort. I don't think that they ever expected that this would be the last word in the way that it kind of has been, because they were hoping that politics would step in and do more. And that hasn't really happened.
So this lawsuit, DEQ had taken out a complaint against Chemours, and Cape Fear River Watch intervened. They got to this consent order one afternoon in Bladen County. A reporter from WECT and I were the only people in the courtroom. We were there for hours, and they kind of went in the back room and came out with the consent order. I think it underwent public review. It took some time to be signed. It was signed in early 2019 and has since been reopened at least once and tweaked a little bit. So to the point that it's not the final word, it can be reopened and has been reopened. And so there is that option. And SELC and Cape Fear River Watch would certainly, I think, make the case for that to be done at various points.
I think it's worth noting that that consent decree has led to what Von Hagerty called the Great Wall of Fayetteville, this giant wall that's stopping all of the groundwater under the Fayetteville Works from seeping into the Cape Fear River the way that it has been this entire time. It's getting captured in wells, concentrated down, and then they have really close limits on how much they're allowed out into the river. I remember covering when this was being discussed by DEQ here in Wilmington that Rob Zappel and some other advocates were like, you're saying that it's going to be 99%, but it should be 99.99%. And, you know, it's all of these like really specific numbers. But because of how much of it there is in that groundwater, it's a substantial amount, those little percentiles.
Well, and I would say the other thing that's funny is if you go to a Chemours dog and pony show, they will tell you, oh, we put the Great Wall in. We've got, you know, our air toxics are way down. Look at all the great things we've done. And I just want to hold up my hand and say, you were forced to do this. This was not, oh, let's spend $1 billion on this technology. They were forced into a corner.
I think of the Chris Rock skit where he's talking about you don't get a cookie for not smoking crack cocaine. Like, you shouldn't get this much public adulation for barely complying with the law that's constraining you after decades.
So turning to the politics of it, one of the pieces of legislation that has been attempted going on three times now is Ted Davis's polluter pays bill, which has been winnowed down and winnowed down and winnowed down to basically just be Chemours pays. I might as well say it in the bill. And Chemours's argument is always, one, we are a good neighbor. Lisa spoke to that a second ago. Two, we should not be forced to pay for everyone else's pollution. I can see the point they're making. They also admittedly polluted the river for at least 35 years.
And that bill, I mean, just as in like that bill is specifically about redressing the costs of filtering water. It would be leagues beyond that to get legislation in North Carolina that was going to address harm to individual people.
Right. This is just to make Chemours pay for
CFPUA in Brunswick County.
The $250 million that we've spent.
Right. And I've been watching those committee meetings, and Ted Davis is doing his best to get people on board. And that bill is dead now, as far as I know. Is it just on life support?
On life support, I think is fair.
Hospice?
Yeah. But let's go back to the first effort for him to get that bill through. And there was a Judiciary Committee meeting, and Davis introduced the bill. And going into the meeting, I think I had spoken to him the weekend before, and he was feeling okay about where things stood. And then in the meeting, every single major business advocacy group in the state stood up and said, this is why we don't like this bill. It was the chamber. It was the manufacturers. It was also Chemours. It was the American Chemical Council. It was the kind of rawest display of corporate flexing that I've ever seen in the legislature. And Davis might as well have had steam coming out of his ears, but the bill was dead then and there. It was incredible.
Yeah, and every time he tries, he gets a little bit closer. You know, the House passed it unanimously this time, but the Senate is just dug their heels in, and you kind of, to Adam's point, I almost have a palpable sense of his desperation. I mean, emotionally, you know, when he's up there trying to explain to people what this has done to his community.
He wants that bill so bad. And just like walking off the House floor after they passed it, I grabbed him for a second. And, you know, Davis, he's not a really emotional kind of guy, but he was thrilled. He was so happy to get that bill passed the House this time.
And it's worth noting, I mean, he's had a long career as a prosecutor and then a county commissioner and now a state rep. This would be the capstone to his political career if he could pull that off.
And it seems like there's just too much lobbying power, at least in the Senate, for this to get through.
The chamber has always been overtly opposed to this bill. And while they were opposing it, they put Chemours on as a destination on their manufacturing tour. I mean, the company and the chamber are very closely tied at this point.
Well, and also remember that the chamber is the organization that was writing to the Environmental Management Commission to not take a stand on PFAS, and now we have that very lame PFAS minimization plan that's in the works. And so, yeah, the chamber has definitely been in lockstep with Chemours on this.
As DEQ was starting to look at their own PFAS rule in surface water, the legislature stepped in and basically remade the Environmental Management Commission, which to that point had effectively been a group of advisors that was open to listening to DEQ staff and typically went along with staff recommendations. That relationship now is so much more hostile than it was because the board was remade. It was remade with Republican appointees who simply do not agree with DEQ staff's readings of this science and are very much doing their own research, for better or worse. And I think DEQ staff is taken aback by this change. Their relationship is totally different. And it's like it speaks to just how hard it is to make an environmental rule in this state now. And that's something that's getting made more and more difficult potentially with the RAINS Act that just got vetoed. So PFAS, I think, is kind of a test case, as is 1,4-dioxane, for can we regulate things that obviously look bad? And right now, I don't think it's too far to say we're failing that test.
I would agree with you, Adam. Adam and I are often in those Environmental Management Commission meetings. There's one coming up. And the hostility is unbelievable, the acrimony.
When did this change take place?
2 years ago.
2 years ago. And we now have two appointees that weren't on there originally that are the ag commissioners now. So you have a lot of folks who are now, oh, well, we don't want to get upset about it in the food.
So there were several kind of – there were two shifts. One was to give the General Assembly some appointees, but the governor still had the majority. So the Speaker of the House got a handful and Phil Berger got a handful, the Senate pro tem. Now those two ag appointees shift the balance to Republicans have the majority of the appointees.
Yes. And the other thing that was amazing in the last meeting, it was at the very end when – the PFAS minimization plan got kicked down the road again. And I remember Steve Keen, who is the head of the Water Quality Committee, said that he was looking forward to new science from Lee Zeldin, the EPA administrator.
Yes. So keep in mind, we are 8 years into this at this point. And there was a meeting last year where Keen literally said, we're going to go slow on this. And I'm not sure how much slower we can go.
That was Adam Wagner of the NC Newsroom. If you're just tuning in, I'm Kelly Kanoyer, and this is the Newsroom. Today, we have a panel of reporters covering PFAS, including Lisa Sorg of Inside Climate News and our own news director, Ben Shockman.
I want to take you guys back to where DEQ was in 2017, freshly into Cooper's term, after DEQ had been, you know, starved for resources. And one of the issues we saw was how far behind they were on the permitting process. Chemours had been out of their permit for a year or more.
I think longer.
I remember hearing Michael Regan say, you know, like, well, the I think Tim Buckland from Star News, now works for the county, asked, you know, when did the permit expire? And Riga told him. And we asked, we were all learning about this on the fly, like, okay, so what does that mean? And we were essentially told, well, we basically just let them do whatever they were allowed to do under the permit until we get around to renewing the permit. And I think we might have used some profanity in the heat of the moment, but basically to ask, what is the point of the permit? And at, like, as I said earlier, like, again, we were mad at everyone at the time. We were mad at DEQ, CFPUA. We were firing shots at everyone because we just wanted answers and weren't getting them. But what started to evolve was DEQ had been choked under the previous governor. And because they were unable to do things, that then gave some Republicans the ability to point at DEQ and say, this agency doesn't work. We need to find a different way to approach this. And that's in part where we got things like the collaboratory. You know, what if we get non-government agencies to, I mean, to the university system in on this with an eye on the profitability of patents, which is a very free market-ish approach to this compared to the regulatory approach that DEQ might have been able to do if they had been fully funded.
It seems to me that what we've come to is that the primary regulatory process that we have is the consent decree, and it only really applies specifically to ChemWars, specifically in the Cape Fear River. Am I right? I mean, we just haven't actually changed state law in a substantial way.
I think not
for
only
protection.
Yeah, not only are we not embracing anything resembling the precautionary principle, we have winnowed down the regulatory approach that we have as much as possible. And things like, you know, the lobbyists for the chemical manufacturers and the chamber and even the agricultural folks are aware that you can find PFAS in anything. And if I believe it was the Manufacturing Alliance who used the term Pandora's box in that WRAL report that sort of opened all of our eyes when lobbyists were basically saying, do not look too closely at this. It'll be disastrous.
And I think a lot of locals also, when Michael Regan became the EPA administrator under Biden, and when these new regulations came out and there was an advisory related to Gen X, I think there was all this excitement because it was like, finally, we're getting the federal government to step in where the state government isn't. And now we don't know what's going to happen with that.
Right. And I remember being in Fayetteville. I believe, Adam, you were there too. The day that they announced the MCLs and I guess the hazard ratios for the other two, but let's just say there were standards. And I couldn't believe that it had actually happened. Whether you thought they were strong enough or too strong, just the fact that something had happened, and it had been a long time. And now the thought that Gen X in particular could get rolled back and that utilities will have more time to rein in the PFAS and the PFOA. And I talked to Emily Donovan about this, and she was saying that, you know, I just feel like so much of what we worked for is being undone.
I think you could chart a path of, like, mass and momentum to get that done. I think part of what you're describing is, yeah, it took a long time, and it probably took some emotional rhetoric, and it took science, and it took political connections. It took every tool in the advocacy toolkit to get those standards across the finish line. And it's not just that we're pausing or going slow. It feels like that was everything we had, you know, as a community to get that done. And I don't know what it looks like to just from a resiliency point of view for people to be able to go back to almost the starting point and do the last 8 years again.
I think that's a really good point. There's this saying in environmental journalism that it doesn't bleed, it oozes. But what happens when it's not even oozing, which is kind of where we're at right now? There's been a lot of work put into whatever's going to happen, what happened last April. And to walk that back, it's tough. It's tough.
It takes a real emotional toll on people because it was, you know, very personal to them. And that achievement, like you were saying, is it took every tool they had, and it finally happened. And Michael Regan was there, and, you know, that was kind of taking one for the home team, you know. And now to have what to most people is a pretty obscure commission on the state side and then just, you know, Lee Zeldin on the federal side, just undo all of that, it's hard to swallow.
I think there's a broader point to be made here too. So Regan was in North Carolina a lot when he was administrator. He was here probably every 3 months, was pretty press friendly every 3 months I had almost routine meetings with him when he was here. And he thought that those PFAS rules were going to be durable. He thought they were – he was very confident that they were going to be able to withstand a second Trump administration potentially. And it just doesn't look like that's going to be the case right now. So what that says about even the federal rulemaking process – I mean, this is all pretty arcane. But, like, you need to be able to make rules, and the rules need to be able to stay in place at some point. And I think that's totally up in the air on the federal and the state level right now.
I want to give you all the opportunity to kind of wrap up your thoughts here. I want you to imagine that I'm where I was in 2021, but in 2025. I'm somebody who just walked in. I moved to Wilmington. I have no idea what's going on. What should I know about this crisis that impacted the community that we live in now?
I think you should know what options are for you to filter your water, whether it's reverse osmosis or filtration or whatever. So I think it's very important that you know how to care for your own health, because I'm not convinced that certain people in power have that same interest in mind.
Cynically, I think you should know that corporate power is willing to outweigh you, that they have the resources to wait until the right set of circumstances come to try to get their way. More optimistically, I think you should know that you have an awful lot of neighbors that have put an awful lot of hours into working on this and are really passionate about fighting for your drinking water.
Yeah, I think I'm a little bit cynical too, but I think one of the things I hear a lot is a kind of defeatism, probably a hard-earned defeatism, where it's taken this long and we fought this hard and Chemours looks like it will win and rake in the money in the long run. And they are only one company. So many other companies who would happily kill you and your family slowly for profit. That's just the history of American industry. And it is very easy to just say, well, the hell with it all. But I think that's disrespectful to the amount of work people have put in over the last years. And I don't know. I still think that something can be done. It is difficult when corporate interests align with political interests. It looks pretty bleak. But we've also seen times when that wasn't the story, and we have made progress. And I think if you lose sight of that, then you really are toast. But I don't think we're necessarily all the way screwed yet.
I want to end on a little note of hope. Lisa has in recent months written about Michael Dowerson, who is a toxicologist who is pretty much a toxicologist for hire for chemical companies. In the first Trump administration, they appointed him to run basically the chemical division of the EPA. And he did not get confirmed because of Tom Tillis and Richard Burr, because of John X and because of Camp Lejeune. So there is a way for these kind of different silos to come together to push back against some of these things that look on their face really, really bad.
And what other choice do we have? We have to get up every day and do something good for the world. And Adam probably feels this too. Just being an environmental reporter in this moment, you can get really down. But I think about the people who have fought. And I think, you know, in journalism has its role as well. And we have no choice. We have to.
I have a lot of gratitude, having moved here in 2021, for the people who put all that work in before I got here. And even though we didn't get to a place where my drinking water was safe when I arrived, CFPUA now has installed these really effective filters that are filtering out almost all of this PFAS, getting it below these levels that the EPA during Reagan's administration said were safe. And that means I don't have to cart my water on my bike anymore. I can actually drink water out of my tap. And I know, because I've covered this too, that it is safe. So I have a lot of gratitude for the people who came before. I want to thank you guys also for coming and joining this panel. Ben Schachman, Lisa Sorg, Adam Wagner, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you.
Happy to do it.
That's about all the time we have left for the newsroom. Thank you for listening. Shout out to our guests, Vaughn Haggerty, Lisa Sorg, and Adam Wagner, as well as the advocates Kemp Burdett, Dana Sargent, Jessica Cannon, and Emily Donovan. Lisa Sorg wrote a terrific article to pair with this podcast. You can read it at whqr.org or on Inside Climate News. Thanks also to my guest editor, Ben Schachman, and program director, Ken Campbell. If you have questions about today's programming or ideas for a future show, you can email us at newsroom@whqr.org. If you missed any part of this show, you can find it at whqr.org or get the show as a podcast pretty much anywhere you can get podcasts. I'm Kelly Knoyer. Thanks again for listening to The Newsroom from WHQR Public Media.